Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. I'll be your guide as we go through the back half of Chapter 4, Section 4, from 4.1 to 4.20 of James Mason's Siege, which is compiled or put together from his newsletter published from 1980 to 1986. As always, you can find what we record at vnnforum.com and eventually at alexlinder.com. Let's dig in. 4.11, 4.11, only on each other. And again, this chapter is about the failure of conservatism, roughly, loosely. I once knew a woman who worked as a checkout clerk in a supermarket. After work, she would relate to me all these little cliques, personality clashes, backbiting, petty intrigues, not to mention the rottenness and carousing of the boss himself. And it struck me that right there, in the confines of a few thousand square feet, involving only a few dozen individuals, was all the same nonsense and all its deadly earnest ferocity that I was running into in the movement at that time. Our struggles, it seemed, were of a higher order with higher stakes and so, therefore, merited such in-house conflicts, whereas to indulge in these stupidities in such a minute fashion where there were no real stakes at all appeared to be most childish. I was rather amazed. Then it wasn't too long before it dawned on me that such silliness properly belonged to the realm of the inconsequential, where no outcome mattered. In affairs of trying to build a viable political movement with aims such as ours, it had no place at all. It wasn't long thereafter that I separated myself from it completely by undertaking what I've been doing with Siege and Universal Order, capital U and O. Idiotic, meaningless struggles, rivalries, quarrels, among drunks, punks, jealous women, gangs of kids, neighbors, co-workers, the right wing, etc. The intrigues, the vendettas, the pettiness, the thievery, the meanness that goes on constantly, with no real outcome, nothing learned, nothing gained, and leading to yet more cycles of the same mistakes. The winners? The system. The pigs. The establishment. The real results? Mutual loss for those who can afford it the least. Making laughingstocks of themselves. One divided against another, even into the family level. Helplessness and ridiculousness. Here again is the difference between the average person and the revolutionary. For one, the revolutionary scrupulously avoids the havens and breeding grounds of common misery and trouble. He stays out of habitual, useless trouble spots and situations. He never helps police against any other, nor does he invite them down upon himself. He doesn't engage in drunkenness or highs. His is self-discipline and clear perspectives. He will never attack or betray a comrade. In fact, he will never initiate any unnecessary hostility, as he has more than enough on his hands, handling matters of urgent importance. He engages in nothing petty, common, or mean. His enemy is the system, as the system is the enemy of one and all. He is different because he knows it fully well and is serious enough about himself and what is at stake to conduct himself at all times in an appropriate manner, as a sober and effective revolutionary soldier. And that was from volume number 15, number 3, March 1986. Strength unencumbered. Some have said, and still say, that these are, quote, pre-revolutionary times, unquote. That's a pretty good intellectual cop-out for a professional faker. But a revolutionary cannot make such a statement without confessing himself to be no more than a weirdo. The degree of vacuum found in this present-day society indicates that this is a revolutionary time as no other before in history. Charles Manson has told us that we must read the books backwards and get all that other stuff, people, places, and events from other times, out of our minds so that we can start dwelling in the now and start dealing with the now. Trying to organize for what? To try to become the Ku Klux Klan, which effectively dealt with the now of the 1870s? To try to become the Nazi Party, which effectively dealt with the now of the 1930s? Or to try to boost a damaged ego? To try to compensate for some frustration in life? To try to escape reality? I've seen it too much. I know it too well. And those few who are or were solid and sincere, what chance have they got trying to carry and cater to a bunch of defectives and screwballs? That's right-wingism also, and not a revolution. And I got tired of it too. The idea is not, or at least shouldn't be, to organize losers so that somebody willing to sink his paycheck into a paper front and willing to get his head busted to get into the press, etc., can feel, quote, safe and unthreatened as a, quote, leader. Nothing comes out of that, as it is an escape, a pressure release in itself. It has, in fact, its own demise built in. I've wondered whether it's the system not allowing the movement to develop into anything, or if it's the movement being unable to develop into anything. One fact is certain, and from it we should all take a lesson. What the system is trying to prevent, what their quote-unquote Maginot line is intended to guard against, is the same thing the movement can't seem to muster. And that is a serious, sober, effective, adult organization. Stalemate, and in favor of the system. Apart from being in possession of the idea, capital I, first, next, the guts and intelligence, the greatest strength any member of the movement can have is freedom and maneuverability. The comparisons between now and NS Germany, or even Weimar Germany, should cease, as there is no useful comparison, so different are the times and manners. No Adolf Hitler is going to join one of these idiotic groups of their absurd commanders as member number 7 and transform the thing overnight. For one, the commander, quote-unquote, wouldn't tolerate being upstaged. For another thing, such a mind as another Hitler would have to possess wouldn't tolerate the monkey shines and shenanigans that the movement is famous for. The nature of things now is immeasurably bigger and more inhuman than any other time or place. There is no time for comedies. And that was Volume 14, Number 7, July 1985. 4.13. Too close to our work. Because of the self-imposed rules the traditional right is always played by, they are so far removed from what's happening as to realistically not count. For effective purposes in national affairs, there are only two camps: status quo, middle-of-the-road conservatives, and, quote, progressive, death-wish liberals. A true right is in no way represented. This, plus the fact that whites have absolutely no real representation, makes for probably the most lopsided political scene of any country ever in history. Who is at fault? right-wing mentality is at fault, and it remains to be seen whether it can be changed, or, if not, whether enough fresh blood or untapped human resources exist in the overall movement, or can be found, to move things in a new direction. I stop short of saying in time, because that kind of phraseology is part of classic right-wingism. Can it be possible to go about something in a flippant, amateurish manner, and yet maintain at the same time an air of utmost urgency? That is the right. Go about something in a flippant, amateurish manner, and yet maintain an air of utmost urgency. That is the right. As I have said at times in the past, I have here rightist tracts, post-war, dating up from 1949, which each in turn give this country about 5 years to go before totally succumbing to degeneracy and subversion, if not all-out military attack. Many of these are of a biblical nature, with the rest being various shades of crack-brained political crusades. A comparatively recent one, which masked, but yet served, a monumental ego trip of the author, who happened to have been there, had it that, quote, Rhodesia must be the turning point. That was from about 1976. Last straw after last straw. That is how right-wingers view things, possibly all things, but certainly the struggle they are involved in. Events have shown that nothing is that cut or dried, or, if you'll pardon, black and white. They say, quote, the end is just around the corner and shall arrive with the very next system sellout. We, on the other hand, say that the end came and went some time ago with regard to the old order and all of the old values. They have it that when their end comes, it will be total and complete. The final triumph of the, quote, other side, depending on which rightist you're talking to and who, in his opinion, represents the other side. We say today that today isn't a hell of a lot different than the Dark Ages of Europe, and that the choice is to either accept the existing grayness and mediocrity or work and fight to bring about a new age of man. As an example, as long as the U.S. and the nations of the West are mired in this mess, things are quite certain to continue to steadily deteriorate, like a state of melancholia which strikes individuals. But as bad as the professional losers would like to have it, if right now a few of the proper orders could be given from places of authority, more than enough strength and vitality remain in the West to completely turn the tables on the forces of decay. I'd say within a matter of 2 weeks. Those, quote, right orders are not forthcoming, however, and aren't likely to be until some new, healthy authority takes over. Total destruction of the high-tech space-slash-computer age implied? Yes, probably. Pitted against the third worlders of today, or of the future, our ancestors in wooden ships with flintlock weapons could kick ass in mighty short order. Rather than 2 weeks, it might take 2 years. All a question of balls. The losers, those already dead, are riveted to a losing formula and thought pattern. To break free, you cannot be one of them. How are you to tell, and how can you break the barrier? That's Volume 10, Number 9, September 1981. 414, A Break with the Past. James Mason says, I'm a National Socialist, first and foremost. Have been for over half my life. and will be for the rest of it. But those familiar with the philosophy of siege will see that I view the party in Germany, together with its tactics, etc., purely as a phenomenon of that time and that place, totally unworkable here in the present. And I must add that Commander Rockwell and his strategy were not of the past or another place and could have worked had he lived to see it through. But Hitler and Rockwell shared one thing in common, which is no longer valid. They both believed, as Hitler proved, and as Rockwell was successfully demonstrating, that the existing institutions of the day, though in many cases subverted and taken over by our enemies, were still usable and could be co-opted or worked through in the building of the movement and the seizing of power. This is no longer the case at all. From now on, all our thoughts and strategy must be based upon this realization. It is unpleasant and uncomfortable to be without the old guideposts and landmarks of the past, which stood largely unchanged for centuries. Yet the fact remains that for the first instance in a very long time, we are absolutely not the masters of our own country, our own affairs. Our people are totally disenfranchised as a race, and there are no exceptions to be found in white company men or white Shabbos Goyim. Do not make fools of the rest of us by complaining to, pleading with, or barking at the system. There have at times been intelligent and sincere people in sympathy with our cause who'd admonish us in the most helpful and polite terms, which I can and do respect, that the Nazi approach can't make it, mainly because something new is required. Something, quote, new. No argument could I ever find with that, though neither could I, nor anyone else, come up with that new, quote, something. Those who pretended that they had were only fooling themselves, for what they created was only a weakened and watered-down version of fascism and National Socialism with different names and symbols. Furthermore, never in practical application did any of it come close to having the effect that Commander Rockwell and his ANP, or subsequent efforts of later Nazi fronts, had. These, quote, new attempts were in fact backward steps. While I cannot go for any of these sneaky approaches, any of these crinkle jammers, because of a personal commitment and devotion to what Hitler brought forth, and out of practical common sense, neither can I allow myself to believe that history's march stopped in 1945. The pages of history read pretty dull since that time, but yet in historic terms, the ensuing 30-odd years don't really represent much of a span of time. The best that can be said for these past three decades is that a number of embryonic things have developed, one or more of which could mature into something. Which ones and how, no one can know. That was Volume 10, Number 9, September 1981. "4:15, 4:15, ready for what? One might be able to imagine, after reading some of what I have to say about right-wingism, how I personally feel about the want-something-for-nothing inquiries that still come to my address occasionally from fossilized remnants of the right-wing age. I feel insulted by their presence and am offended at their wanting, quote, free samples of revolutionary literature. We're struggling, they're piddling. Usually these take the form of a partial sheet of school kids' notebook paper on which has been scrawled, please send samples of your literature. Never any money, seldom even a request for subscription rates. Then there are those who feel that if they provide a good, standard, right-wing litany in letter form, then they are entitled to a freebie request thrown in at the conclusion of the letter, and all is even. You always get the sinking feeling that at the end of each of these pep talks, there it will be, the bite, and you're right every time. Again, this pre-internet. Readers of Siege will know that I hate idle complaint and try to avoid it wherever I can, but one of these letters came in about a month or so ago, which sort of broke the camel's back and prompted this particular segment to be written. It was, quote, standard all the way, except that at the close it had, quote, ready to fight above the author's signature. It was too much for me. I didn't gag, but I did get steamed, and still do, whenever I stop to consider it. Ready to fight. Ready to fight. Ready to fight. Kick it around in your mind and roll it over your tongue a few times. I'll bet I could draw you a picture, complete with personal background and history, on that individual just going from experience with these types and making a composite. But I won't, because that would make me sick for sure. Ready to fight? Yes. I sent him a copy of Siege in response, which probably scared the hell out of him if it didn't entirely confuse him. And no, there wasn't any further communication. But ready to fight? 10 years ago, I might have stopped and written him a letter containing much of what I am saying here, but not today. I have vowed to cut waste. Ready to fight, eh? So what's the delay? Waiting for a bell for the next round? Waiting for some hippie or nigger to come jumping up onto your porch? If you're really ready to fight, why not take it on your own? Like Cowan, Spizak, Matthews, or a dozen others who fought. What in hell are you waiting for? Is this the conscious evasion of a coward, or an idiotic lack of understanding on the part of a blowhard? I know how the rest of it goes like this. Quote, ready to fight when the time comes. Even when the fighting is, and already has been going on, it's still never quite time. No, not everyone is a fighter. That's understood around here. But don't come on like a fool, and don't use that term to hide behind. I will show respect for anyone who approaches me in seriousness and who is willing to apply themselves seriously. And a serious approach in this case would have been something like ready to work or ready to serve. As it was, this person wasn't even ready to subscribe. This is an insult to all who do work and serve, in quiet, without fanfare, and especially an insult to those who do fight and pay the ultimate price. I can't tolerate it anymore, and I won't. Let the fakers keep to themselves, as there are plenty of faker-style groups out there who thrive on hot air. Not around here. Ready to fight. Son of a bitch. Volume 14, number 3, March 1985. 4.16. Revolutionary setback? With Ronnie Reagan having trounced Jimmy Carter, can we consider ourselves saved? Can we quit and relax? Not if we're revolutionaries. All that Reagan is going to do, has already done, is rock the conservative types back to sleep again. Jimmy Carter at least jolted them out of their apathy partway, which accounted for the, quote, landslide turnout of voting cattle over previous years' careless attitude, when it looked like the electorate might shut down altogether, a revolutionist dream. As long as the enemy remains in control of this country, he is going to go to the limit to maintain his Democrat/Republican shell game. And, as Joe Tomasi said, the people will go on playing party politics no matter how bad things get. Some may think we can afford to go a little easier now on revolution and give Ronnie a chance. Maybe get a little more mass in our strategy and thereby hopefully avoid some of the leaner times ahead due to the conservative bandwagon. Most will be doing this very thing out of opportunism and roll with the blows reaction, which is all they know. Not us. Ronnie Reagan has done only one thing, and we as revolutionaries must view it from both sides of the spectrum. First, he may have bought some time for the system. Second, right now only the Reds are in a position to take advantage of a general collapse. And maybe Ron has done us a favor, too. Unless we are dead wrong, then Ronnie is not going to alleviate this nation's mess one bit. Simply because he can't. Because he is a system boy. Ronnie is as much a system boy as Jimmy. He wants to keep corporate profits high and, wherever possible, keep the serfs, be they black or white, it matters not, appeased. Being a system boy, Ronnie Reagan does not only recognize any of the real problems of this country, on the contrary, they are some of his best friends. So cheer up. Things will get worse. For the sake of conducting a reaction survey, how much conservatism do you have left in your blood? Did you somehow come off with a cleaner feeling when Ronnie beat the pants off of Jimmy? Do you feel vicariously vindicated or somehow satisfied by the sudden rush to the conservative camp by a bunch of edgy middle-class Americans? Would you welcome an easing of inflation or a lessening of unemployment? Would you like to see a beefed-up U.S. Army or bigger police forces? Why not an outright return to the Eisenhower or Nixon years? Do you enjoy playing hide-and-go-seek with the FBI, KGB, or trying to second-guess what a conservative, reactionary Supreme Court might cook up for us radicals and rock the boaters? Would you get that warm glow inside, seeing, quote, the people, again, having faith in what's supposedly their government, and turning their backs flatly against actual reform? Well, if so, you ain't one of us. Ralph, here come the Reverend Abernathy, said it all when he backed Reagan over Carter because, as he put it, under the Carter administration, the forces of racism have experienced an upsurge. Jimmy, we're going to miss you. We want bureaucratic hangdogs like Carter out front, and not cowboy heroes like Reagan, to give people a false sense of security and leadership. We want, as our revolutionary incubus, the most vile and decadent form of liberalism, so that we may run wild and free. We do not want a repressive, conservative, don't rock the boat atmosphere, which suits the cheap labor, high profits, one man, one vote, bourgeoisie, just dandy. If we can't get the gutless masses to join in an effort at retaking control of America from the enemy, then we at least want them to keep out of our way in complete apathy when the day comes for us to break the current impasse. We don't want law and order, but rather we want the people so terrified by crime that they'll be ready to accept anything which promises to lead them to safety. We want them sullen and disgruntled and not happily participating in the, quote, democratic process. Above all, we don't want a police state with our worst enemies at the top pulling the strings. We don't want a business-as-usual atmosphere. We want an atmosphere conducive to revolution spilling over into the streets. Should Ronnie be somehow able to put even a little dent in inflation or any of the rest of the boogeymen pestering the mindless consumers of this country, then it is bad news for the revolution. If not, and Ronnie disillusions his conservative fans, then we could easily experience a spurt in general revolutionary sentiment. It doesn't matter if they are betrayed by the government unless they feel they have been betrayed. We can't worry about a revivified FBI, KGB, or an increasingly heavy-handed judiciary. If we are worth a damn at all, then we must expect to see our movement banned by the government, by a frightened system, just as it happened in Germany, and for that matter Russia, many, many times before victory became final. The incoming Republican regime is, in fact, just the same old system wearing a different mask. And regardless how clean Ronnie Reagan may seem next to Carter, his bottom line policy is the same. Try to make the Negro look white by reducing whites to the level of would-be Negroes. So, live the revolution. Volume 9, Number 8, December 1980. 4:17. Two rules. Since having gone the rounds myself on more than just a few occasions, it keeps coming back to me more and more these days that most of the travails encountered in day-to-day life can be bound up in two areas and generally dispensed with in two very basic rules. Number one, cut your losses. Number two, never make the same mistake twice. I was formally introduced to rule number two after I had joined the staff of what was then the national headquarters of the party. It was told to me by one of the old-timers who was shrewd enough, even then, to make his career behind the scenes, where the turnover and the fatalities weren't so rife. To the 16-year-old I was at the time, that simple statement illuminated an entire universe of clear thinking in the area of just plainly playing things smart and keeping control of yourself. What I have termed rule number one, I arrived at independently some years afterward. It is because you're going to make mistakes eventually. Everyone does, even the best. And if you're unable to master and overcome these initial errors, you won't survive to go on with the learning and maturing process. In other words, you're way ahead of the game if the mistake you commit the first time doesn't do you in. Rule number two takes a back seat because it is only a matter of the intelligent learning process. However, it is to be emphasized due to an entire world full of people who never catch on to it. They just keep sticking their hand back into the fire. The trick is, of course, being able to know when one is confronted with a problem, the dynamics of which he has faced before, as circumstances may be entirely changed. If there is another trick to this, then it has to be the ability to know that a mistake was made the first time around, and precisely what that mistake was. In connection with this one, that same old timer in the 1960s told me this, quote, "The first time, it's the other guy's fault. The second time, it's your fault. Don't be found at fault." Cutting your losses has to assume first priority because it involves applying acquired skills. Skills, by the way, which the timid and reserved never get the chance to develop. So you're caught right in the middle of a big one with your hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. As I've said before in Siege, few things in life are as clear-cut as the cookie jar, and you normally will have room to maneuver if you don't immediately make a bad or potentially bad situation into a worse one. Avoid the human slash animalistic tendencies to cop out or cave in, or on the opposite side, to explode and do the inappropriate thing. Small concessions, if made intelligently, can sometimes be the only way of staving off major disaster. In many ways, a lot hangs on what you don't say or do. Volume 14, number 10, October 1985. Four eighteen. The enemy is anyone who attacks. I've said in the past that the enemy was indeed anyone who attacked for whatever reason, and that it was vitally necessary to know what amounted to an attack in order to be able to ascertain one's real enemies. You don't wait until the bullet has left the muzzle. And in the huge spectrum of human struggle and endeavor, the fates of nations and individuals, as often as not, are decided upon matters far less dramatic and clear-cut than the use of firepower. More often these days, it is intrigue and guile which decide the course of the future. To be undone by a bastard who has not declared himself your foe, or who has actually painted himself as a friend, is one of the worst fates imaginable. If just that much can be avoided in a person's life, or in the life of the movement, then we will be halfway home to victory. But to know what an attack is, to be able to identify an enemy, is not enough, as anyone with strong beliefs and values worth fighting for will have already found out. You can depend upon an endless stream of those who'll seek to cross you up. But can you always depend upon yourself to be perfectly ready and willing to deal with all comers? Today's friend, tomorrow's enemy. In revolutionary politics, your potential worst enemy is always your closest associate. Not only does he know you, but he also knows, quote, where all the bodies are buried. Are you ready to deal in a summary fashion with the problem once you have received enough early signals that someone close is about to or already has begun to turn on you? Can you be certain? Can you act? How about close blood relatives? Can you at one stroke cut them loose in the way the Manson family cut loose their families in favor of their greater, real family under Manson himself? If the answer is no, then you are prime sucker material, and I wouldn't give you 2 cents for your chances. This is not going off half-cocked. It is going around with a hair trigger. Years ago, in a publication predating Siege, I printed an appeal, a plea to members of the movement not to engage in games or trickery against my circle at that time, because we would have absolutely no choice whatsoever other than to consider such behavior as an attack and take appropriate steps, even more aggressive and belligerent countermeasures of our own. I cited movement harmony and unity as cause for my appeal. Predictably, it fell on deaf ears. Francis Parker Yockey has said that to attack someone who is not a real enemy is to ultimately attack yourself. Those in the latter part of the 1970s who chose to attack us for no reason other than to try to eliminate competition in their imaginary, quote, power struggle are no longer in the forefront of movement affairs as they were at the time. I do thank my lucky stars for the ability I've always seemed to possess for picking up on little hints that trouble is on the way from certain quarters, in advance of its actually breaking the surface. If it is an instinct, it is only a knack for detail. It has never betrayed me. It saved me a number of times where otherwise I would definitely have been lost. It has but one drawback. Once convinced of an impending attack, or at the very least, of perfidy that cannot go unchallenged or unpunished, but without any overt action on the part of your enemy, so as to be noticed by outsiders, strident and vigorous countermeasures give the appearance of unprovoked aggression. Sympathy is thereby lost, and certain condemnation is incurred. In practically every case I've been involved in, I've had to stoically assume the role of the bad guy in the issue. This is fine with me. If you haven't already learned the actual worth of sympathy, or having been, quote, dead right in an issue, then I fear for you. To have never been a sucker, to have kept on winning, at whatever cost, will always be worth it to me. The tiniest, most insignificant of details have tipped entire schemes of personal aggrandizement that would have been at the cost of the movement. A certain inflection placed upon a single word in a talk, The inexplicable disappearance of an item no bigger than a thumbnail. Equations which just don't add up. Things which most people would write off without a second thought have time and again tipped the balance. When an attack is planned, and as it becomes more imminent, the element of surprise takes on greater and greater importance. Naturally, many times things will appear fine and dandy, as long as the plotters feel that this appearance is to their advantage. This again makes it doubly difficult to try and warn others, or to try and justify yourself to others whom are not involved in the intrigue, as no one wants to believe such things, and no one wants to disrupt what has the look of a perfectly normal and peaceful state. During 1978, in a transcontinental telephone conversation with one highly respected movement leader, I laid out the scanty evidence as I had it and submitted my conclusions based thereon. Treachery was underway, and an attack could be expected at any moment. His response, aside from utter incredulity, was that I was, quote, turning on my last friend. The reverse was the case, as the individual on the phone was forced to admit within the week. Earlier in siege, I referred to the thing which Hitler told his troops as they prepared to go crashing into Poland to avenge 1,000 wrongs accumulated over the previous 20 years. He said, at that time, quote, close your hearts to pity. As though these troops would need to be reminded, you might think. At least as often as not, these situations come up suddenly, as their plotters intend. The instant the facts are clear to you, you must abandon all hesitation, all remorse. You must immediately determine that no quarter can be expected and that none shall be given. You have to determine to do whatever is necessary in order to win. And it matters not against whom, once they have demonstrated that it is conflict they want. Comrade, friend, family member, it doesn't matter. The first few go-rounds you experience, assuming you survive, you'll have to keep reminding yourself of this. After that, it becomes instinctive. None of this is to be confused with the phenomenon I describe as the instant bastard syndrome, where this or that person is a queer or a Jew or an agent simply because they disagree with you. This type of right-wing behavior does the movement a grave disservice, not only because it muddies the water and actually helps the real agents, but because it has the effect of cheapening real enmities. Mere name-calling and coming to grips with, or matching wits against, a determined enemy are two distinctly different things. The syndrome I outlined had one other feature. It is generally transient. I was once accused of threatening movement unity because I, quote, refused to be parted from my revenge. So it may have appeared to the accuser. It is rather that I view planned attack at any time or planned disruption inside the movement to be among the most serious kinds of crimes. They don't blow away. The passage of time has no bearing upon their status. If an end cannot be put to such an issue right away, and if merely foiling a plot or stabilizing a situation is all that can be done for the moment, then the conclusion has no choice other than to rest on hold until such time as it can be settled permanently. In the meantime, others will rise up in their order and demand solution in turn. Such is the cycle of life's struggle. It is not expected by me that anyone will learn anything by it. Volume 13, Number 1, January 1984. Four 19. Rejoinder. Parentheses. This segment was written as a response to Tom Metzger's circular letter to members of the movement calling for a stop to the nonsense, the, quote, cul-de-sacs, as he called them, that continues to get the movement nowhere fast. In summary, and I have to express my total agreement, we must drop the role-playing of the past and join in one true and realistic movement ideology. In the next paragraphs, I'll attempt to give my impressions of what is called for, not on the basis of what I'd like to see, but on the basis of the direction circumstances appear to be taking us. Close parentheses. I am sincerely gladdened that Tom Metzger's and George Lincoln Rockwell's ideas in no way contradict one another. And Commander Rockwell never favored a Hitler cult, so don't confuse that issue. He merely said that we can't cringe to Jewish intimidation and we must never deny our true heroes. What Commander Rockwell did clearly state, up to the end of his life, was that it would be the economy and not the race issue that would tip things off in America. Experience is bearing this out. Despite any degree of racial resentment or friction, the fact of the matter is that Americans are losing their racial consciousness, their racial identity. Talk to the kids, and you'll see what I mean. This doesn't mean that with the right leadership, it can't be quickly reversed, but it does mean that the race issue is a dead horse with regard to the founding of a truly revolutionary movement. This isn't as bad as it sounds because, as Charles Manson says, the kind of racism that America was known for and which the Jews, liberals, etc. attacked and still attack was not the sort propounded by Hitler or any other racial philosopher. It was of a negative nature. Otherwise, the enemy could never have succeeded in undermining and destroying its basis. Redneck racism was based on hate, fear, ignorance, and plain snobbery, etc. Hitler's kind of racialism and Manson's was and is based upon natural order. It has yet to be seen and demonstrated in North America. It is for the continued betterment of the white race that we fight, but that is only our stated purpose. Our means are going to have to take a different form, or else we are going to fail in what we're trying to achieve. Assuming enough people can come up through the levels of struggle to where they may be loosely referred to as professional revolutionaries, then they'll still require the right approach and the right tools to use, not merely to survive, but to launch a successful attack of their own. And these will be economic and social issues, the meat and bones of realpolitik, the stuff upon which the true governments in the wings cut their teeth. No fun, you say? Not lofty enough, you say? Perhaps, but it should be pretty obvious by now that fancy letterheads and screwy crinkle jammer names, I don't even know what crinkle jammer means, something German, backed up with tons of specious philosophical gobbledygook, won't get it. The Jews accuse Hitler of going to the very core, of touching every wound, and so he did. That is why he won. The movement here today talks shit, and that is why it is where it is. I have yet to see a real program offered by anyone representing the racialist movement in this country. Never. I have seen things that purported to be programs which use a lot of musts and super-duper idealistic phrases which don't even move me, a member of the cause. The first time somebody gets real on paper and in the spoken word, that's when we'll have the start of something big. Why don't I do it myself? I've thought of it. I've wanted to. But I'm not qualified. I might be able to make a stab at it in collaboration with others in the movement to see what can be hammered out. Take a look at the 25 points of the NSDAP, or, for that matter, at the U.S. Constitution, and know that whatever is created will have to top those, and try to and tell me that anything close presently exists. There is your ideology, and there is your unity. Furthermore, I know it can be done, but will it be done? Volume 12, number 12, December 1983. 4.20. Has anything been gained? Yes, as far as I'm concerned, headway at least has been made regarding certain intangibles. While no hard achievement has been made over the past 30 years, a kind of think tank or brain trust, together with the essential knowledge denied to any outside the movement, has been provided where special individuals can spend their time honing themselves for the final challenge. If we are so lucky as to get the chance of coming to grips with it at all. Also, if the nonsense of the past, the getting nowhere fast, can be said to have served any purpose at all, then that would have to be likened to a laboratory setting, arranged and supplied specifically for the finding of a solution of one problem, and wherein experiment after experiment is tried, the failures duly recorded and examined for what valuable lessons might be gleaned from them, and then shelved so as to be able to get on with the next experiment with the lessons of the past in mind, to perhaps give success a higher percentage chance to occur. What must be drawn attention to here is the number of those who insist upon repeating the same mistakes year after year, bringing them along with their baggage to each new endeavor they may associate themselves with. Every attempt to create a revolutionary organization that I have witnessed to date has been ruined in this fashion. those unable to see a 30-year pattern of failure truly are part of the problem and the enemy of the solution. One other gain, independent of any action of ours, is that trends in the world have progressed to the point where so much of the old right-wing I told you so has become so grotesquely manifest that we can unburden ourselves of it, as we no longer need it to, quote, convince anybody. The time of the individual choice is upon every white man and woman, within or without the movement. Argument is fading fast and being replaced by, will you have a white world and an environment in which you can live or not? We may safely dispense with a lot of peripheral trash formerly used to confuse the issue and divide the movement. The hopes and efforts of the past can only be considered wasted if one either quits outright or keeps on repeating the old mistakes. It would appear that the path a few of us have kept to is converging with the path of destiny, and it remains now to clear our thoughts of useless garbage and to thereby be able to coordinate our actions accordingly for maximum results. That was volume 11, number 10, October 1982. And that concludes section 4 from James Mason. Section 4 was called Conservatism and the Lost Movement, so kind of a summary of the lessons they've learned as James Mason saw and where they were in position to the politics of the day and people's general thinking. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real, real soon, and we'll pick up with Section 5 of Siege.